The celebration of Epiphany is actually an older feast than Christmas. Christmas didn't really start being celebrated on December 25th until about the 3rd century. And even in America, it comes late. By the early 20th century, only Catholics in America were celebrating Christmas, and Protestants considered it just another excuse for Catholics to drink. But then Santa Claus entered in, and commercialism, and it became popular all over America. But in the 1900 or so, it was mostly a Catholic feast. Easter has always been celebrated from the day one, because that is the, in many ways, the central essence of the Paschal mystery, the dying and rising of Christ on the cross. But the incarnation came to be realized as a part of that Christ mystery, that Paschal mystery. But before it was celebrated in the West on December 25th, it was celebrated on January 6th in the East. By East, I mean Constantinople and Jerusalem. And Epiphany is another word for manifestation or illumination or revelation. All those words are kind of interchangeable in the biblical texts and in the church's theology. So it's illuminating, shedding light on something that was already true, but people didn't know it. So when you reveal something, you uncover the shroud that was hiding it from your sight or from your understanding before. And so the star in the gospel text becomes a symbol of that light. It's the light shining from that star that shines on the Christ child. Now, in Judaism, one of the great insights of Judaism in the Old Testament period was revelation. Unlike the Greek and Roman mythologies, which were cleverly concocted myths, in other words, they were of human making, and those religions never pretended that they came from anything but the human mind. And of course, they're very clever and great literature, and we still study them in literature classes today, and there's great truth in those. But there was never any pretense that they came from anywhere but from human invention. But in Judaism, it was all about revelation. We know who God is because God told us who God is. We didn't imagine God. We didn't make God up. God revealed himself to us. And one of the great ways that is celebrated in the Old Testament literature is through events or deeds. What are the actions of God that reveal God? And of course, God does things. God acts on behalf of Israel. So he hears their cry of distress in Egypt. He sends Moses to actively save them, to rescue them. He works all these miracles and the plagues and all that. Then he parts the Red Sea. See, this is all the action of God. And then he leads them through a 40-year, that is a lifelong journey in the wilderness, and forms them into his own people. So the Old Testament, in many ways, shows or reveals a God of action. But as the Old Testament period progresses, the expectation of a Messiah, something more than just action, but a person, is going to come in the future and reveal what we don't know already. And so, in Jesus, we see that personal revelation. Jesus is the great revealer of the truth that always was, of who God is in the Trinity and what that looks like in a human person. He's the great revealer, but he is also the one being revealed because he is God. So the expectation of a Messiah gets transformed rather radically when Jesus actually comes, because it's not an agent from God, it's not a messenger from God, it's God in a human body. So he's the revealer, but he's also the one being revealed. He is revelation itself. And that's why the star shines on his crib, shines on his person, because this is not a revelation, a truth, it's the person of God in human flesh. Well, so this great insight of Judaism that God is the revealer of God's self was rather limited. You notice in that Isaiah prophecy that we heard as our first reading, composed probably 700 years before Christ, it's a rather myopic vision. He talks about the darkness surrounding Israel. On every side, all the other nations, they're all living in darkness because they don't have this revelation. And the only way they're ever going to get it is to come here. And so in that reading, caravans and dromedaries and camels, they're coming, they're streaming toward Jerusalem to get revelation. They're never going to get it out there. They're only going to get it in here. So it was nationalistic. You know, Israel is where God is active. And so if you're going to find God, you're going to have to come to Israel to get him. So then Jesus comes and turns that inside out. So the gospel message isn't about Israel. It's about the world. And so what do Paul and Barnabas and the other missionaries do? They take the gospel message to the world. They don't expect the world to come to Israel. They go out to the world. And that's how we ended up here. Most of us come from European stock. If they hadn't taken the gospel message out of Israel, we probably wouldn't be here doing what we're doing now. Because we come from Gentile origin. We come from the northern tribes, a lot of us. We come from Asia, some of us. We come from India, some of us. We come from Latin America, which comes, you know, finds the gospel message many centuries later. So because the church is missionary, because the gospel message is taken to the Gentiles rather than waiting for them to find it, that just transformed everything. So, if Jesus is, in his person, the revealer and the revealed, then that makes him the fulfillment of all the Old Testament prophetic expectation. And so, three expectations are expressed in that gospel story. That he is a priest, that he is a prophet, and that he is a king. But of course, he expands their expectations of all three of those things. First of all, he's a king, but he's not an earthly king. Unlike what Herod was expecting someone who was going to challenge his own kingly authority, and so he seeks to kill the child. But when Jesus, when the fullness of Revelation appears, he's not an earthly king at all. He's king of the universe. He's king of everything in creation because he's God. But he's king in that universal sense. And so what do you give a king? You give him gold. It's a royal medal. He's a priest. And what do? They offer incense. And so frankincense is the second gift that the Magi bring. And then the third gift is myrrh. And myrrh is a product that you anoint dead bodies with in preparation for burial. So what happens to the prophets? They all get killed. And where do they get killed, Jesus says? They get killed in Jerusalem. Jerusalem kills the prophets. And the prophet par excellence, Jesus, where does he die? He dies in Jerusalem. So there's a kind of a foreboding. The Christmas story is not about cute baby Jesus only. It's also about the adult Christ. It's about his death and resurrection. And in the East, when they celebrate Epiphany, they celebrate the baptism of the Lord on the same day and in the same celebration. Here in the West, we've separated those out, so we're going to celebrate baptism of the Lord next Sunday. But in the East, they celebrate those two together. And so it's a kind of a mixed experience. There's the bright promise of a child. There's this future possibility. There's this hope. But at the same time, we're aware of his impending death on the cross. So the Christmas mystery is not just about baby Jesus. It's about the cross, too. And the myrrh is a reminder. It's a harbinger, you might say, of what is to come. Now, that prefiguring of his death is not entirely negative, though. Because we Christians have always known, haven't we, that death ends in resurrection. That the death of Jesus on the cross is not the end of the story. It's just the beginning of the story. And whatever death we're going to die in this life is not the end of our lives. It's the beginning of eternal life. And so we celebrate death all the time. Every time we gather for Mass, we're celebrating the memory of the cross and the Last Supper. But we don't do that out of any morose sense or, you know, any flagellation or beating ourselves up. It's filled with hope because we know that death isn't the end of the story. So remembering his death is also remembering his resurrection. It's also expecting his coming again. Think of the words that we hear in the Eucharistic prayer every time we celebrate Mass. Looking forward to his second coming. Proclaiming his death and resurrection and ascension. And the sending of the Spirit which breathes that life of Christ into us and transforms us into participators in that Paschal mystery. That this is not something that's just a theological construct that we admire. It's a life lived. It's about how we live our Christian lives filled with the hope of eternal life.